Tonight, we're going to talk about telementation. And of course, you know what that is. It's like the law of attraction. Our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM, Jeffrey Grupp. He is an empiricist. And as I mentioned, experience is the only source of knowledge. That's what it all means. And we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let me tell you about Jeffrey Grupp, a radical academic and, as I mentioned, empiricist, a former college teacher at Grand Valley, Western Michigan, Purdue, and Indiana U, where he taught philosophy and more specifically Eastern philosophy, ethics, metaphysics, and Buddhism. And here he is on Coast to Coast. First time. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on tonight. Longtime listener, big fan. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Good job, by the way. You do a lot of great work. It's fascinating. You know, you had me running around for the last 2 days trying to find out exactly what an empiricist is. And I finally found it. And how did you become one?
I had a number of pretty good professors that in anthropology back at the U of New Mexico who were very, very close to being the radical empiricist in the sense I am. And that's basically the idea where you reject everything you're told and only you only believe in certain things that you can experience. Now, not everything you can experience, because not everything is true that you experience. But if you're going to find something that you know, it only can come from that source. So that's why, you know, conspiracy theorists are, they're in the direction of the empiricist, because they will, you know, if somebody tells them, you know, there's global warming or something, they're going to say, wait a minute, I want to see this with my experience. I want to see this with my eyes before I believe it. I'm not just going to believe what somebody tells me. So an empiricist in the true sense, you know, the old sense of the ancient philosophers and Renaissance philosophers who developed this, really took this seriously and said, you know, the only thing we can know is things from our experiences. And it really comes out to be true. If you really want to know things, this is the way. I mean, you might lose friends because a lot of people want to just go by what they're told and will get irritated with you for being so logical. But, you know, aside from that, knowledge is joy, and this is the way to get it.
When you talk about, you know, knowledge is joy and experience is the only source of knowledge, I mean, listen to this. Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of State, he's pitching his book, so he's going all over the country. He was working, of course, during the 9/11 period under the George Bush administration. And he was on my buddy Mankow's program today, I guess. And Mankow asked him about Building 7, which went down and was never hit by a plane. And apparently Rumsfeld says, I don't know anything about a Building 7.
Yeah, that's just playing games right there.
Unbelievable. I mean,
yeah, we all saw, from the empirical account, what we have is a televisual image of a building going down, which looks exactly like a controlled demolition. Better example, even, I think, is the Pentagon, where before that roof collapsed, you know, 20 minutes after there was an explosion there, there weren't even any buildings or any windows broken on the outside of the Pentagon. I mean, these are empirical accounts of a televisual image that really give us some powerful information. So when Rumsfeld says, I don't want to, you know, he basically denies the information. He's steering away from the empirical account. Often when people want to trick you or something, or they'll get angry at you for being a skeptic, angry at you for being empirical, because those are the points of true knowledge. And if they're trying to steer you away from true knowledge, they'll get irritated with you or just make things up or deny things. I mean, we all saw Building 7. It's been on, you know, even the mainstream media has it now. So that's, you know, more par for the course with that guy's been.
Oh, it just makes him sound like an idiot or a liar, you know, or maybe both.
Well, think about this. Rumsfeld was the guy. I described this in my book, Corporatism, a lot. He said he was there at the Pentagon on 9/11, you know, running around helping out after the so-called plane hit. And, you know, how could that be the case that he could get on TV an hour later and say a jetliner hit when he was running around the lawn there? There weren't any plane pieces that were of any significance. There wasn't any evidence for the super hot molten plane inside the Pentagon and so forth. So it's pretty disturbing. It almost shows, it's almost a good account to say that he was aware of a pre-planned fabrication there, you know, to have that lie all set, you know, an hour after the explosion there.
Well, you know, years ago, I would hear conspiracy theories. And of course, that really started in this country during the JFK assassination. And at that point, you know, I was just a kid. I was 13 years old. But I just, even then, I questioned the line that Oswald acted alone. And as I got older and older, Jeff, you know, I began to look at more of these conspiracy theories. And, I began to say to myself, there's got to be some truth to some of this. You know, these people who believe this can't be whacked out. Not all of them. And, you know, the older I got and the more research I did, regardless of what the topic was, I began to realize that there's some truth to all of it, if not most of it.
Yeah, the whacked out account appears to be the person who says the conspiracies are whacked out. I'm not, you know, it's not that all the conspiracies are conspiracy
right.
theories.
There's not a conspiracy under every stone. I mean, and that's important for people who want to look for true conspiracies to realize that. But they're out there and they're real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an empirical standpoint will show you this. I mean, if we look at evidence from the what we've been shown in the mass media about 9/11, we do find something strange. Now, it's weird that shows up in the mass media. I mean, in a sense, the mass media created the latest huge wave of conspiracy theory, which comes from 9/11 primarily in the last decade. It's interesting to think about how they created it, the mass media. I mean, they could have hid the images or covered things up. I mean, it's really easy to cover things up in mass media, I found out. You know, barely any discussion of depleted uranium exists in the mass media. For a good example, you know, Joyce Riley talking about that on your show. You know, so they could have hit it, but they didn't. So it's almost curious to me that they would this is what I describe in my book, Telescreen, which I know that your producers were saying that you had interest in.
Yeah, they got it right in front of me.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that the Telescreen world, which I describe in that book, it's almost the case that conspiracy theorists will, like myself, I mean, I've been a conspiracy theorist for over 10 years, and, you know, just realizing certain things doesn't necessarily wake me up. I mean, I could become aware of 9/11 as, you know, being questionable from the account that we're supposed to believe in the mass media of the planes hitting and, you know, no Building 7 and so forth. But on the other hand, think about it, the mass media created me. Having these, you know, led to me having these questions, created me as a conspiracy theorist. So that means I, even as a conspiracy theorist, am under the control of the telescreen world. The telescreen world is so unbelievably pervasive, even an experienced conspiracy theorist may still be under its control. So what does that mean that the mass media is largely behind creating the conspiracy movement? I mean, they're creating the Republicans, they're creating the Democrats, they're creating conspiracy theorists, they're creating anti-war protesters, pro-war protesters.
Yeah.
It's amazing the power of this world, you know, the telescreen world we live in. And I don't think, you know, a lot of us know, yes, television is so powerful, and if they say one thing on TV, then we're all talking about it the next day at work, so they can control our dialogues and consciousness in that way. But do we really know how much it's inside of us, how much it's twisted our souls and so forth? I mean, how different would we all be, for example, if we grew up in the forest like American Indians did and so forth, and, you know, that was what, you know, created our consciousness, listening to birds and the wind and so forth, compared to, you know, listening to cartoons and now, you know, all the mass media.
Jeff, what's your take on what's been going on in the Middle East over the last month and a half? I mean, from Tunisia to Egypt, problems in Yemen, Bahrain, parts of Saudi Arabia, definitely problems in Libya. What's happening here? I mean, originally they talked about social network, Facebook, Twitter, the ability for young people to uprise. I think it's more than that. There's something going on at the root of society that people are just beginning to say, I've had enough. And I mean, they charge commandos with weapons. They don't care. I've never seen anything like this.
Well, doesn't it, George, just kind of seem like something's going on really big all over the place? I mean, not just the Middle East. There's just a lot going on. It's almost like we have this feeling the world is in transition.
Yes.
I mean, my wife and I were just talking the other day. We were comparing ourselves as parents, we have three children, and to all of our friends that have children. And we were saying, you know, the style of parenting seems to have changed over the last couple decades. I'm 40 now, and, you know, we can think back to when I was 10 and so forth. You know, and we were going through all these things that have seemed to have changed. Even, I think, the style of government has changed in a bit. I mean, not saying it's better or worse or anything, but there's strange things going on. Why did Obama put medical marijuana in the power of the states? I mean, that's really curious. That basically is going to start a huge medical marijuana revolution, which is already brewing in, you know, California, Colorado, and here in Ann Arbor. It's alive and well, that's for sure.
Yet the feds still say they could come in and arrest. As much as it's going to be states' rights, the feds still don't want to wash their hands of the whole thing yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's strange how it's going back to your question about the Middle East. One thing when you say there's something more going on, I definitely agree with you. Isn't it curious how, I mean, there's been riots all over the place. I mean, southern Mexico's had tremendous riots for a long time because of election issues there. Africa's had riots all over the place. And the mass media has largely ignored it. So therefore, going back to the idea of the telescreen world, then we don't sit there in our offices at work the next day discussing it because it wasn't on the news. But now, all of a sudden, they're covering all kinds of riots. And a lot of the Egyptian riots, a lot of them weren't as big as was said. And they were kind of even a lot of, it seems like Libya was driven by the mass media covering the Egyptian ones, so people through their media knew that one was in Egypt. So now, the fever is sort of out there and it could spread like wildfire all over the place. It just makes me really curious how this whole thing erupted, how now all of a sudden the mass media is covering all these riots, whereas for so long, decades, they ignored it. So it makes me think perhaps there's some kind of plan. I mean, there are these sorts of plans in the mass media. My book Telescreen goes through them over and over. We were told from early 1990s to 2003 that Iraq was a threat. I mean, NPR, the so-called liberal station, told us this. Fox News, the so-called conservative station, told us. They both said the same thing, and we found out it all kind of wasn't true.
Yep, we all got duped. We all got duped on that one, didn't we? But you know, we always questioned, at least we did on this program, Jeff, as you know, we questioned the weapons of mass destruction, what's going on, and you know what? We were right. They never existed. And even the president, George Bush, says, you know what? Okay, they weren't there. It's just amazing, though, how you can manipulate the masses to believe anything you want to tell them.
Yeah.
That's scary. I'm going to throw a lot of things your way tonight during this discussion. We're going to talk about God and the cosmos and just about everything else. So I want everybody to hold on for this coast-to-coast ride. Tell me a little bit more about yourself beyond just the bio.
My website's antimatterradio.com, and I'm a college teacher. I've taught all over the place. I teach here at a small college right near Ann Arbor, where I live now with my family. My favorite thing in the world right now is my wife and three children. We have a little baby.
Good for you.
She's 4 months old, and that is taking up all my time.
Oh, that's a lot of work, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolute ecstasy, though, I will say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Detroit's my hometown. I was born there. Mm-hmm. Spent some time in Ann Arbor rooting for the University of Michigan, as I'm sure you do.
Yep.
And, my Ohio State friends always jump around when Michigan plays Ohio State, but it's a great area. My dad just turned 88 on February 22nd yesterday, and he called me today and he says, "When are you coming up here?" I says, "I'll come by and see you in April, Dad." And he said, "All right." They had about 9 inches of snow. So I'm sure you got pelted too, didn't you?
Yeah, I actually didn't. I was in Croatia over the weekend, and I didn't see it, but I heard it was something. My parents are in Kalamazoo, and their power was out for almost 30 hours. Their house got down to 44 degrees and so forth. So.
Well, at least they didn't get under freezing and pop those pipes, huh?
Yeah, exactly. They were worried about it, that's for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about the existence of God. How do you look at that question, the existence of God?
George, I used to be just dramatically enthusiastic atheist all through the 1990s and up till about 5 years ago, until I always said, as you would expect, I will believe God exists when I have the evidence for it, the experience. Something in my experience shows me evidence for God's existence. And you
wanted hard evidence?
Yeah, I wanted more. I've been a Buddhist I'm sort of a Buddhist and a Christian at the same time, a Christian more recently, obviously, but I've been a Buddhist since the 90s, and a lot of my meditation experiences, I really was into it hardcore back in the 1990s, a lot of my meditation experiences sort of suggested that there is a creator everywhere, but I kind of said, okay, that could be interpreted different ways. It could just be nirvana or you know, something that's similar to it, but not necessarily. Yeah, I wanted to see that the cosmos is designed and so forth. And it seems to, from what I've uncovered over the last couple of years, I mean, it's me using the work of others, not that I'm the only one who uncovered it. There is evidence for the existence of God in several different forms. I mean, if you just look at the solar system, there's very clear evidence that things like the golden ratio, the mathematical ratio, is all over the cosmos. It's in our DNA is described by this mathematical pattern. You know, this arrangement of items, which has a mathematical map to it, which is called the golden ratio. It's a non-random mathematical arrangement. It's not something like pi, which if you have a circle, you know, pi is just built into it. This, the golden ratio is not like that. It has to sort of be, you know, put into place for it to be there. It's not something that randomly pops out of nature. Now, it's interesting, we find the golden ratio built into galaxies like, you know, M100, and there's a whole bunch of other ones. The golden ratio is found in something that looks very similar to galaxies, which is hurricanes. It's in our DNA. It's in our faces and hands and teeth and fingers, toes. It's in sunflowers and pine cones. And, you know the famous examples are the conch shells. Now, the most interesting one of all, the one that absolutely made me, you know, fall off my chair, is one of the most recent discoveries. The golden ratio is in quantum chaos. I think it's the first pattern in quantum chaos ever discovered. This just happened like a year ago. This was discovered.
Really?
Yeah, and they found...
Why did it take so long?
Well, the quantum domain... I'm not sure exactly that question, but I think it just took so long to find any patterns at all in the quantum chaos, because quantum reality, of course, you know, is devoid of most understandable physical laws. It's a domain of something, you know, higher is going on down at that level. So, you know, a new set of laws that we're not familiar with in our physical orientation we have, you know, in our materialistic perspective with our senses and so forth. But the first pattern they found was straightforward, pure as can be, golden ratio. And, you know, that really got me jumping. I mean, how in the world can you have this? And these aren't just fabricated examples. I mean, I'm making approximations or something. These are all discovered by academics. I mean, the quantum chaos can only be discovered by, you know, things in that can only be discovered by academics, because they have the instrumentation for it. You know, so that's one thing. And that, yeah, this is just the beginning of it. There's all kinds of other mathematical patterns and so forth. So the question is, how can we have the same non-random mathematical patterns everywhere? It seems that, as the ancient philosopher Plato would say, you know, there's a creator and it's a mathematical intelligence.
Well, see, you know, that's interesting, because I'm like you, Jeff. There's no doubt in my mind at this point that there's a creator. We'll call it God. What I don't know, what I haven't been able to put together yet for myself, I mean, other people have sent me emails and books and everything else trying to give me that answer. This is an answer I think you have to find yourself. I don't understand why. I just don't. I believe it exists. I believe it's responsible for this incredible magnificence in the universe, but I just don't know why.
The concept of God is utterly mysterious. I just described Buddhist experiences I had that really pointed towards the existence of God. And now these experiences, I was so into Buddhism. I still am, but back then it was, you know, I was in my 20s. I didn't have anything else to do. I was just meditating constantly. And, you know, I would have an experience of a light that's everywhere, a sort of a very ultra energetic light, absolutely just imbued and emanating love. Now, that's very similar to Christianity. You know, in Christianity, God is supposed to be everywhere. God is light. God is love. And this thing I would find out, this was communicating with my feelings. It was almost like it could understand the textures of my feelings. You know, there's another tie between Buddhism and Christianity. It seems, I'm not trying to prove that point, that those are the same religion, but there are enormous similarities between the two. But yeah, it is mysterious, George. Like you just said, you know, if there's this all-loving creator behind things, why is our world such a disaster? Poverty, war.
Exactly. Jeff, stay with us. Let's get back to this point when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Jeff Grupp. We're talking about his work, The Telescreen, Corporatism, Telementation. His website, antimatterradio.com. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. We're with the philosopher, Jeff Grubb. I guess I could call you that, can I?
Yeah, I teach philosophy, so yes.
One of my favorite courses, and I went to University of Detroit, and
I'm going to be teaching there in the fall.
Oh, you're kidding. It's a no. Great school.
Yeah, absolutely.
I, you know what? You may be working for Dean Marske.
My boss's name is Gail. Gail okay. Presby. That's all I know,
don't know
so
her.
Far.
Because I graduated in 1972, so they've changed. But I'm on a committee there, and we've done some work for them. It's great campus. It originally been in a real tough area of Detroit, and they've been working on it. And but it's a great university. So yeah, good luck. Good luck
Thank
if
you.
You get out there. As a matter of fact, if you're there, I'll put you in touch with a friend of mine, John Simtek. He used to write for the Detroit Free Press, who graduated from the University of Detroit, and he knows everybody out there.
Oh,
Jeff,
good.
So that would help you a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, back to God. Why? As a philosopher, have you answered that?
No, probably not. But like we were saying before the break, it's if you can grasp the mystery of God's existence in such a crazy world, then you would get somewhere. You know, how can there be this omnipresent force of love and that's, can hear your thoughts and respond to your feelings and so forth? Why, if that entity is responsible for creating everything, would the cosmos be filled with such unbelievable, our world be filled with such unbelievable hurt? And it really is. I mean, you think of all the people on Prozac. You think of all the death going on with war and starvation and so forth. This world is a big mess. I'm not trying to be pessimistic here. It's just empirical. There's big problems. I mean, it's hard to realize that sometimes Americans get pretty comfortable. But, how can these two things go together? I remember in graduate school, a lot of philosophers would try to argue that God doesn't exist because there's things that aren't love in the cosmos. They would say, okay, if God is love, then and God created everything, then everything would be an emanation of God, and therefore everything would have to be imbued with that kind of love. You can't have the opposite quality come out of God. That would be like saying all loving being, which is only capable of love, created something that's not love. And that's a pretty strong argument. It's pretty interesting, and it gets to the essence of how we can have this mysterious scenario of part of me thinks maybe it's just real simple. Maybe it's just, we're in God's image. We're creatures that are built for ecstasy, our physiology with the pineal gland and meditation and love and, with music and so forth. We have the capacity for ecstasy. We're built for this. And maybe it's just that we are, like in the telescreen world I was discussing, we are just damaged right now, and our consciousness just needs to get back to where it was. You know, the way Walter Crutenden describes, we had golden ages in the past. I know you've had him on your show.
Yeah.
So maybe it's that simple. But then again, I don't want to make it too simple because it's a very mysterious thing.
Well, I've concluded for myself that God's not responsible for all the great things and all the evil things in this universe. I'm not so sure it has the ability to control that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I drop a pen, there you could just hear it drop. I mean, did I create that or did God? Now, that's another mysterious thing. I mean, God is, in the Christian tradition, God is supposed to be all powerful. So if I can do something and God's not responsible for it, is God the origin of all things? Is God, does God have power over that event? So, a lot of people want to say, yes, God does have power over those things, but I don't know. I mean, I'm supposed to be. This is what my book, Telementation, gets into. I'm a creator, okay? If, like it says in Genesis 1:26, we're in Elohim's image. So, and if God is a creator, then we are too. And this is to the extreme sense. It says in the Bible, your faith can move that mountain. That's what Jesus said. So, I mean, it should be the case that we have the ability with our essences, our souls, to radically create or destroy reality as we need to, since we are creators. So, no, that would have seemed that God is not responsible for all things. Understatement, really. That humans are, like I was just saying a little while ago, perhaps it is just our fault, that the world is such a mess. Maybe it is our fault and it isn't. I mean, perhaps it's just our distortion right now. Maybe the sun's magnetic field is lowered now because we know that magnetic fields applied to brains can change consciousness dramatically. Maybe we just need a stronger magnetic field in the solar system.
Maybe. Let's go back for a moment, Jeff, to your atheist days.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume for a moment that at that point in your life, you were correct, and that there is no God, that everything that has happened here has been random. It's been an accident. It just happened. I just can't understand that.
I could. I loved that framework. Now, I can't understand it now so much. I don't know where I'd be. But in those days, I absolutely loved the idea that there's no intelligence behind things, that everything is completely random, that there's no known divine reason for my existence.
It just happened.
That was a very different time for me, but it's associated with fatalism in a lot of ways. Fatalism can be a very relaxing philosophy. You sort of just give up. That doesn't mean you don't go to work or something. It means you stop trying to fight with things and you just let everything happen as it happens. I mean, from a certain point of view, if you take this to an extreme, it's a very de-stressed, peaceful lifestyle. And if you're into meditation, for example, as I have been, that you may really want to seek that, because you may want a really relaxed mental state, so you can, that's very conducive to meditation. So there's lots of reasons why I was in that position, but I mainly just denied God because, well, part of me was repulsed by it because I kind of had a distasteful upbringing with Christianity.
Well, religion tainted you, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. There's religion on the one hand and then God on the other.
Yeah.
Buddhism and Buddhist followers.
You know, I try to separate religion and spirituality. To me, they're tremendously different. One is, and there are a lot of great religious leaders on this planet. There's no mistake about that. But it's also, in many cases, it's deceived us. They have manipulated us. They've taken advantage of humans. They've scared us into believing certain things. So I think it's got its problems too.
Oh yeah, I don't hold this, the thesis that, you know, religion is the cause of all wars and so forth. I think something like the New World Order or Illuminati would be responsible for all those deep problems. But
yeah,
religion is responsible for one great theft. I mean, our God is ecstasy. Human life is meant for ecstasy. Go study the American Indians 200 years ago and tell me that's not true. And this is what religion has stole from us. We're supposed to believe that Christianity is just merely about belief. Well, if that's true, why did St. Paul on the road to Damascus fall down in a spiritual ecstatic trance? Okay, you know, that's spirituality, not religion, like you were just saying. You know, the same could be said of, you know, the point of Buddhism is to change your humdrum, boring old everyday consciousness into sheer bliss. That's the, Hinduism has the same message. So that is the biggest thing I think religious leaders have taken from us. Is they've made religion look, I think the Dalai Lama is the best example of this. He makes religion look like sort of a political idea set. And that's absolutely not what it is. It's an experience of absolute holiness in you. All of you, every single person listening has this. And deep down, whether you know it or not, what you want more than anything is this deep satisfaction and joy. And this is the exact thing now most people on the planet don't know exists and what we're supposed to be seeking.
So at this point in your life, 100% convinced that there's intelligent design here?
Yeah, I have to be, from what I've seen. I mean, I've got a whole list of, I mean, I've you know, done so much analysis into all this intelligence all over that, yeah, it's a two-part designing. It's humans or other entities in the cosmos like us. I don't know if animals can do. This is what telementation is, with your feeling level of your consciousness, not your thought level, your feeling level of your consciousness, you create reality. And there is no joke here. Beyond this is testable, experimentally verifiable. You know, William Tiller has written whole books on this. Other professors have. And this is studied by the Russians in the 1920s, American universities in the 20s and 30s. There is, anyway, to answer your question, though, yeah, there is design everywhere. The essence of our existence is design. A synchronicity is an example of design. I mean, if we live in a random universe, it's not design. How can synchronicities happen? If you really pay attention to your life and they're just on autopilot and you're really watching the events of your life, synchronicities are absolutely unbelievable. They are so prevalent, so outrageous and amazing that you almost want to fall down in amazement. But you have to be paying attention. You can't be, you know, thinking about, you know, the latest television show or something. You have to be watching the events of your life. Everything has like a code and is lined up together. I mean, take DNA. This is one of the best examples, George. DNA has what's called junk DNA.
Right.
Silly name. It's the non-coding, so-called non-coding part of DNA. I don't know if I believe that it is non-coding. But anyways, it's the majority of DNA. Now, it was found out again, this is something academics discovered. Even though they don't focus on it, they should. They discovered it and kind of put it on the shelf then. It was found out that the pattern of the, you know, the little pieces of the DNA, the junk DNA, it was found if you take those and assign them, you know, and find out what the pattern is and their relation to one another.
And there is. And there is pattern.
Yeah, and it exactly, George, is a language code, a human language code. If you, in other words, if you take human language and say, okay, what's the base of all languages and, you know, what they all share in common and find a code in that commonality. And people have done this for, you know, this has existed for 20 years. ZIPF, Z-I-P-F, is one of the first pioneers to do this. You find a code. That code is exactly in human DNA. This is the most unbelievable information that there is. There is such planning here. This has all kinds of ramifications. Language is an aspect of consciousness. George, why would DNA have an aspect of consciousness built into it? Does that imply consciousness is a lot more far-reaching than we originally thought? You know, and why DNA? DNA is a crystal. It's sort of a light energy molecule with all kinds of, you know, it's got the golden ratio built into it, all kinds of interesting number patterns which imply design and so forth. So a lot of this isn't discussed by academics, but they're the ones discovering this stuff. It's almost like in academia where I work, you know, they have all their theories. They make their discoveries, which are extraordinary. And then they have their theories, which almost destroy a lot of that in a lot of ways. I mean, there's been discoveries lately, which now I know a lot of your listeners believe in the theory of evolution, and that's great. I don't, from things that academics have discovered. They've actually discovered things, like it's called punctuated equilibrium. We can discuss it later if you want, but completely undermined the whole idea of evolution, not just human evolution for other animals with primates, but all of evolution. But they don't see this yet. It's because, you know, they've made the discoveries, but their theories, you know, they have a theory in their mind. Evolution is true. So they can't get past the theory to see the empirical information.
Let me ask you about something you write about quite a bit, dark ecstasy. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. I was hoping you'd bring that up. That's, I think, maybe the most important issue there is. I think telementation and dark ecstasy, in my opinion, are the most important issues. Now, a friend of mine at a radio show called Black Helicopter Radio wrote, he has a quote of mine on his website. It's dark ecstasy is the, I was reading here, dark ecstasy is the spirituality of the Illuminati and a force that has, to a degree, been implanted into humans, where humans have a capacity to develop spiritual euphoria surrounding artistic experiences of genuine sadomasochism, death, murder, war, and pain, and so forth. Dark ecstasy's spiritual euphoria becomes addictive and is triggered by art forms in the world, is the opposite of the experience that someone has of joy of nature, such as the ocean surf. Now, somebody might have to go back and listen to that again in the archives or something, but in a nutshell, what that is there is, this is heavily related to what we were talking about earlier about the mysterious nature of God in a disturbed world. There is some kind of force or something that humans either are infected with or have the ability to apprehend, which is very, very dark. I mean, serial killers have reported that in their crazy rituals of dissecting bodies and so forth, all of a sudden, for some reason, there's a total physiological euphoria and ecstasy in them. Now, George, why would that be the case? Now, let me just tell you, if you have, unless you want to change direction here, let me tell you very quickly why I know about this. I fell into this, and a lot of people I found out have. When I started writing about this and doing, you know, YouTube broadcasts and stuff on this, I found out lots of people know exactly what I'm talking about. And the only way you can know what I'm talking about here is if you have a taste of it. And basically, it seems like incredible amounts of people have. It's just a sort of idea that all these things that should not be joyful, like suicide, abortion, riots, you know, acts of pain, hurting animals, acts of complete non-empathy and so forth, these will develop a strange ecstatic joy within a person. Okay, now, and that's strange that that's there, especially if we're in an intelligently designed cosmos with an all-loving God. So it almost implies something else has tainted us at some point. You know, for the same reason that half of the front part of our brain seems to be shut off in various ways and inactive, that seems like somebody or something tampered with us. So this is another way to look at it. Why would intelligently designed beings have this darkness in them? Now, The real point about dark ecstasy, this is just what I started calling it, dark ecstasy, that I fell into this back in my Buddhist days for a number of reasons. And again, that's how I discovered this exists. But when you discover it exists, you see that the whole world seems to be operating according to this. Now, why would a movie like Sin City, which has in it, there's discussion of, there's a serial killer in the film who discusses that the serial killing, the act of it, reduces a white light and makes the serial killer feel the power of God. Now, I don't know what God they're talking about, but the point is they're talking about exactly, in one of the most popular movies made recently, exactly to nitty-gritty details of what dark ecstasy is. Now, lots of movies, Shutter Island talks about this, you know, Resident Evil films, Silence of the Lambs, Natural Born Killers, and so forth. And then you find other things like Hurricane Katrina. When you're in the dark ecstasy mode, when I hope people don't go there, but when you're in it, you can sort of see that it's an art form. You know, it's something in the world will happen. There will be a piece of art, whether it's a riot or a war or a nuclear bomb or a piece of a film or a piece of Picasso's art or something, and it will trigger in your consciousness a sort of euphoria. Now, this is discussed in Zen Buddhism, not in the dark, but in light ecstasy sense. Zen Buddhists will say, you know, you can be doing your meditation and go out for a walk, and all of a sudden, bam, the most beautiful song of a bird you hear suddenly from the tree above you, and it just pushes you over to the edge into spiritual enlightenment. So there's this idea out there that the environment can create ecstasy. Now, in the Buddhist sense there, it's the environment of, you know, nature and beautiful things that can do that. But there's a dark aspect of this, too, where sadomasochistic murderous art can trigger someone into the dark ecstasy that, again, it's mysterious that it exists. Now, when you start to recognize these forms of dark ecstasy in the world, and I'm going through this quickly. I made a whole film about this, three-hour film. But it's, you find out that the whole world seems to be, you know, video games. The best example is wars. These things feed a spiritual frenzy, a dark spiritual, artistic, sadomasochistic frenzy. So, and it appears, now, how could this be the case? Why would the whole world, for strange reasons, be steered in this way, if I'm explaining this clearly enough quickly here? And the only answer I can come to that is there's a dark force behind it doing it, as if this is, if there is an Illuminati, which I think there is, you know, dark magicians behind the
whole
thing.
No question about it.
Yeah, absolutely. this is their religion, and their world is their art. Remember how I just said the world triggers the ecstasy? Well, they must be using the whole world to do this. You know, the secret underground prisons of torture and so forth. Like in the movie, what's that one movie that was out? I can't remember, the crazy torture movie about the person in the secret prison in Europe. One of the most popular movies. I just happened to forget the name. You know, so it seems like Hurricane Katrina is such a perfect example. I mean, all the, you know, the riot and the frenzy. Remember Jim Morrison, he was sort of like, you know, an amateur, not a professional dark ecstatic, I don't think, like the Illuminati, to put it in funny terms, but sort of like I think David Lynch, the filmmaker, you know, Wild at Heart, Lost Highway, and so forth, I think he's like an amateur dark ecstatic. You know, Jim Morrison would try to create riots because it was an art form for him. He would read, you know, literature by Hitler and social control and so forth and try to figure out how to make his concerts turn into riots because that was what's beautiful to him. So that's like flirting with dark ecstasy. So I don't know. I hope I'm explaining this right, but this is, if you want to understand how the world works, this is it, I think. I mean, why is the world so, you know, yes, there's the aspect of how can a God-created universe allow this. That's one issue, but putting that aside for a second, to just by brute force understand why our world is the way it is, this seems to be the best theory.
All right, well, we're going to come back with you in just a second, Jeff. Fast hour, two more to go with you. When we come back, I want to talk about the law of attraction. I want to get your take on what it might be through the eyes of a philosopher and how it might work. Much more to talk with Jeff about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com.